welcome to the Ringer MLB show. My name is Ben Lindberg. I'm a writer for TheRinger.com. And on the other line, despite the fact that his last three articles for The Ringer have been about football or basketball, is my colleague, Michael Bauman. Hey, Michael, still interested in talking about baseball with me?
A little bit. You know, are you interested in talking about baseball after you've been writing about video games in Nashville for the past 2 weeks?
I am not one to talk. I didn't even mention your article about the size of athletes' hands.
I was going to say, I've committed, this is how dead it is. Since the last time we talked, I've committed more words to paper about DeForest Buckner's freakishly large hands than I have about the hands of all baseball players.
All right, so we are going to get creative today and find a way to talk about baseball despite the absence of very much baseball. And later in this episode, we are going to talk to Nathaniel Groh, a writer for Fangraphs, who wrote about a hypothetical scenario by which Mike Trout could exploit a legal loophole to become a free agent today and make all the money. And after that, we're also going to talk to Meg Rowley from Baseball Prospectus about the Mariners and their somewhat perplexing transactions and starting rotation. But first, we are going to talk to someone who has done his best to keep the stove hot all by himself. As we speak to him, he is a member of the Chicago Cubs organization. We hope for his sake that that will still be the case whenever you're listening to this episode. He is a left-handed pitcher who spent the last couple seasons with the Seattle Mariners and has become something of an off-season story after changing teams five times in, I think, a 36-day span via the waiver system. So, David Rollins, hello. It's been a couple weeks, I guess, since your last waiver claim. So maybe things have settled down slightly.
Oh, yeah, man. I'm hoping so.
So how familiar were you with the waiver system before this offseason? Because it's something that, you know, fans will hear about, but they won't necessarily understand the ins and outs of it. And maybe as a player, if you've never really been subject to it yourself, it's not something you pay a whole lot of attention to. But now that you have been claimed five times, it seems like you probably know all the rules and regulations.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't know anything about it. I mean, I've had a couple of teammates get put on waivers and stuff like that. So honestly, I didn't really know how it went down. And then just kind of summed it up to my family and friends that pretty much is you get taken off 40 man, you get put on waivers. And they were just asking, oh, well, when's this going to be done with? And I'm just over there like, man, I wish I could tell you what I'll be done with. It's just one of the things I'm going to have to go through for the rest of my career.
Like, how has your reaction to getting waived and claimed changed over the past couple weeks? Because I imagine it's like routine at first, then frustrating. You know, at what point does this just become absurd?
Well, I think after like the third time it happened, I'm just like, geez, man, can this just be done with already? You know, and then it just started getting to where it was kind of funny. Like, somebody would ask me, oh, well, what team are you with? And I'd tell them, and then, like, the next day, I'd get put on waivers. So it's just been kind of a little bit of a joke with my friends and family. Just, you still with this team, or are you on a new team yet, or...
Are they, like, going out and buying Rangers gear that's, you know, that's obsolete after 5 days or whatever?
No, not really. Well, like, all my friends and family, I mean, they're fans of me and whatever team I play for, and then they're diehard Ranger fans. So they already got a ton of Ranger stuff. Like, one of my really good buddies, he told his wife that I was with the Rangers, and she's like, well, guess we're going to be broke now because we're just going to buy nothing but more Ranger stuff. So, but a lot of my family, they're Ranger fans, they're Astro fans. And, I mean, then when I was with the Astros, like, I had a friend that had a bunch of Astro stuff. I mean, they've been kind of holding off on getting anything.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you had to pick the teams that were doing this with you, you could have done worse. Like, you know, the Rangers have claimed you twice. The Cubs have claimed you twice. There was a Phillies claim in there. But, you know, at least there's the positive to take away from it. You're a Texan. So if it's the Rangers claiming you, well, at least you get to stay closer to home and your family's Rangers fans. And if you're with the Cubs, well, they're the best team in baseball and they just won a World Series. So either way, right. I guess there's a positive spin you can put on it.
Oh, yeah. Man, I mean, that's how I was looking at it. I'm like, well, you know, I mean, either way, like, I'm going to be with a pretty solid team. And then I got picked up by the Cubs again. I was like, well, you know, I mean, can't be upset about it. You know, like, I went from being back home to being with the best team in baseball.
Right. So how do you find out that this happens? Who calls you? When do you get called? What do you know? And how do you know it?
Well, the last time when I got picked up, my agent actually told me. I had no idea. And then, I mean, I'll get somebody from the front office or like the GM or assistant GM or somebody that'll call me and they'll just let me know. They'll be like, hey, we put you on waivers and so-and-so picked you up. Oh, okay. Well, appreciate it. Glad to be with the organization for 3 days or 20 minutes, like, you know.
Is it the same person calling you multiple times? If it's the Rangers and the Cubs claiming you twice and other teams putting you on waivers twice, is it a repeat? Is it the same person?
Yeah. I'm really bad with names and especially being with five teams and like you said, 36 days, it was just like, oh, yeah, I remember you now. Yeah, I talked to you. Talked to you last time. So, yeah, it's been the same person.
Your entire career has sort of been one weird transaction after another because you got drafted four different times, which is itself unusual. You were involved in that crazy 10-player trade with the Blue Jays and the Astros, and then you were a Rule 5 pick. So do you, like, get a rewards card or something, you know, for weird transactions? Do you have a different way you'd like to move before your career's over?
No, not really. I mean, I'm just thankful that I still get to play baseball, you know, like it's just a blessing every day to be able to go out and play a kid's game and have fun and be around all the greats and like people you grow up watching play the game. And then next thing you know, they're in the box facing you. Like Big Poppy was he's one of my favorite players ever. And I faced him twice, and I mean, it's just like, dang, dude, like, this man is a monster. I mean, he looks way bigger in person than he does on TV. But I mean, when I got to pitch against Boston last year and this year, I pitched against him twice, and I mean, I was just still amazed at the fact that, like, I'm on the same field as one of the greatest hitters. And then, like, you got all the other guys like Edgar Martinez and Scott Brosius, and then you just get to talk to those guys. You got Robbie, Felix, Cruz. He's one of my favorite players as well. And, I mean, just great guys, great information. So, I mean, that's just rewarding enough.
Hopefully you get the free agent deal in here at some point. You've got the draft, the trade, the waiver claim, the Rule 5. But the free agent one, that's the one you want, I guess.
Yeah, that one would be nice.
Does it change your preparation for the season at all? Like, I guess the silver lining here is that this is happening over the winter, so it's not like you're actually traveling back and forth between these cities. But, you know, like, does each team that claim you say anything about, like, what they want you to work on for spring training or, like, you know, what's your off-season workout plan or whatever, and then you have to change that the next time you change teams? Or was there just not enough time to get into that kind of thing?
No, like, it's pretty much stayed the same. They'll ask me, like, what's my routine and stuff, and I'll tell them. And, like, they'll ask who I'm working out with. I mean, I got a really good trainer. He knows. Well, he's actually AAA trainer for Tacoma, or for Seattle and Tacoma, and he lives in Dallas, like right down the road from me. So I mean, me and him we work out every day, and he knows what I need to work on to help me perform better. And it's just one of those things that, like, I tell the trainer that, and they're like, "Oh, okay. Well, just keep doing what you're doing." So, I mean, it really doesn't have to change much.
Do you have a theory for why you have kind of ended up on this carousel or this merry-go-round? You know, I guess the positive is that there are teams that keep wanting you, but I guess you're also kind of on the bubble wherever you go. I mean, there's always someone, it seems like, who every winter and sometimes even during the season gets stuck in this sort of waiver rotation. But do you have any theories about why this has happened to you specifically?
No, I mean, well, I mean, the only thing I can think of is I'm left-handed.
Yeah.
So I got blessed being a lefty. So That's the only thing I can come up with. I haven't really thought about it that much.
So, you know, this is a job that requires a lot of travel and a lot of moving around anyway, even if you hadn't bounced around, because, you know, you go between minor league levels and from AAA to the majors. You know, how refined is your packing system? Like, do you have, like, I know I can get all this stuff into my car in 60 minutes and get from Tacoma to Seattle or from whatever AAA city to the major league city. Like, do you have everything that well organized by this point?
Oh yeah, I've gotten it well organized. I got my bag that I leave at the house no matter what, like with like just extra clothes. And then I got my other suitcase, and only time I unpack it is when I'm washing clothes and I put it right back in there.
So on your Twitter that you got a dog. Who takes care of the dog when you're bouncing around?
Oh, that's actually my roommate's dog.
Okay.
Yeah. So he stays at the house, and I mean, when my roommate's gone, I'll take care of him. But like, it's hard to have a pet during the season just because of this. Like, you move around, you never know where you're going to be at that time.
Right. And, you know, with the road trips, like if you're only in a city for a couple months, it's hard to like make friends with the neighbors to the point where you could ask them to, you know, to watch the pet or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly. And then I know like some of the guys that have pets, what they'll do is they'll send it to like a pet, like a dog babysitter. So calling them up, I'm like, hey man, can you watch my dog for a couple of days? And they'll just pay them for that. And then when they get back, they'll just pick them up.
So among baseball writers, there's just sort of this list of like, if you're going to travel a lot, like you got to get the Marriott rewards points. You know, you got to book your flights using this credit card, this airline gets you the best points and stuff like that. Is there a, like a system or a, you know, a set of travel secrets that ballplayers share with each other that you're willing to share with us, I guess, that, you know, not betray the fraternity or anything?
The only one I've been told to do is do the pre-check, so you don't have to.
Yeah.
And the few times that I've had to, the few times I've had to fly, it's been like I've kind of been pushing it a little bit, and I was like, man, I wish I would have did that now. But I mean, most of these dudes, they'll sign up for whatever airlines we fly with, and they'll rack up points and do all that stuff. And I mean, I think that's what most of them do, but I mean, I'm not a big fan of flying. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, we weren't sure which team to contact to arrange this interview, so we just reached out to you on Twitter, and I know that you are kind of nervous when you see a new number on your phone now, just because you've gotten this news so many times this offseason. So I appreciate your talking to us about this and taking our call and just being a good sport about it too, because, you know, I guess that a different player might not be so philosophical about all of this and, you know, might find it frustrating, but you seem to see the humor in it.
Oh yeah, I mean, you got to have fun with it, man. You know, I mean, especially getting to do something you love. So I mean, if I can have as much fun as I can with anything with baseball in my career, man, I mean, I'm all about it.
All right. Well, we hope that you stay in one place and that it's a place you want to be. And thanks for coming on, David.
Hey, thank you, guys.
All right. So we are going to go straight to our second guest. Since it was a slow week in baseball, it was a big week for Mike Trout hypothetical scenarios. Someone sent me a video of Mike Trout taking batting practice left-handed in high school. So I did a thing about that and how would Mike Trout his as a lefty. And even more interesting, I think, was something Nathaniel Groh wrote for Fangraphs. And he's an associate professor of legal studies at the Terry College of Business at the University of Georgia. That is a mouthful. He is also the legal analyst at Fangraphs. And he wrote this week about what would happen if Mike Trout became a free agent, not years from now, but right now. Hey, Nathaniel.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
So this was really interesting. It's not every day you write a blog post and then you get a Scott Boras response to that blog post. So that was cool. And we'll talk about that. But can you lay out the general scenario for how this would happen?
Yeah, sure. So there's this law in California, basically, that said it's been on the books since the 1870s, I think. And so the law basically says that personal services contracts, in other words, employment contracts, can't last longer than 7 years. Every employee has the right every 7 years to be free from their employer and have the right to kind of go out on the market and explore other options. You know, so I was kind of exploring, well, what's the implication of that or the application of that to the sports industry. And it's something that's never really come up in the court system, at least. And just kind of, you know, in Major League Baseball, it's particularly interesting because the way the CBA works, the team that drafts a player gets their rights for 6 or 7 years at the minor league level, and then potentially 6 more years at the major league level, and which extends well beyond that 7 years. And so, you know, there's arguments on both sides about how an actual court case would play out, but kind of the nuts and bolts of it would be that after 7 years, you would have a right as a player to opt out of your contract if you have been working for a California team for 7 or more years. And then at that point, regardless of what the CBA says about your free agency clock, according to California law, at least, you should have the option to become a free agent 7 years into your career.
You know, even if this doesn't happen with Mike Trout, my biggest question is, you know, what's the call to action here? How do we create this scenario that, you know, to get, if not Trout, then like Garrett Richards or Sean Doolittle, who you mentioned in your piece, one of those guys to sue for free agency and throw the entire system into chaos? Because that's really what I want to see.
Yeah, I think that one of the big questions that like kind of I still have about it is just who like the actual player would be that would do this, you know? And I think kind of what, you know, Ben mentioned Scott Boras's, you know, kind of take on it. And I think that that's one of the big, you know, issues is just, it's a pretty narrow category of players that could actually, that this would actually make sense for, because it only applies to the 5 California teams, first of all. So you're eliminating, you know, 85% of the player pool right there. And then you've got to be with the team for 7 years, but then you also add in kind of just the litigation uncertainty and the time that's going to take and the money, more importantly, that's going to take. And you got to find this guy who, you know, has enough years left on his contract that it makes sense to spend 2 years tied up in the court system, and that the payoff potentially is going to be big enough that it's going to justify those legal costs. And maybe it's not a present day case, but to me, the best case scenario to try this would have been Madison Bumgarner a couple of years ago, especially coming off that, you know, insane World Series and postseason performance, and given how team friendly his contract is and how many years he had left, it still has left on it. That type of case might have made more sense, you know, to a guy who obviously had a, you know, pretty big injury, you know, potential injury risk, and, you know, a super team friendly contract. He could have stood to make, you know, $100 million at least by trying it potentially, I guess.
And that's right. That's the next question. It's because you brought up that the holdout that Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale had back in 1966 was related to this law. And it was just sort of shocked that nobody had tried it since then. But it's just like the player's situation, and I guess, you know, the player's personality has to play into that somehow. So it's just the needle is just that small that nobody's threaded it in the past 50 years.
I think that that's probably right. You know, like you said, personality, I do think, is a big factor too. Like,
right. Cause Trout doesn't seem like the kind of guy who would do this.
No, not at all. You know, and if it was Bryce Harper playing for the Los Angeles Angels, maybe it's a different story there. But yeah, I agree. It kind of has to, you have to have a lot of different stars aligning for it to really make sense. I think one interesting thing about it is there was that Koufax and Drysdale example from back in the 60s that were threatening to do this. I didn't mention it in the piece, but when I was researching it, I did come across a news story from back in the 80s. Magic Johnson signed this like insane contract with the Lakers back in 82 or 83, I think, if I remember the year right, where it was like a 25-year contract that paid him $1 million a year. And I forget if it was Jerry Buss or the general manager of the Lakers at the time, they basically acknowledged that he could opt out after 7 years. And so there does seem to be this recognition, at least in some cases, that it could apply. There's been some rumors that I guess the Cubs might have added an extra year to Alfonso Soriano's contract at one point because a California team wouldn't go that far due to this law, I've heard. But, you know, it does seem like something that's potentially out there, but it's definitely a lot of uncertainty, too.
So it sounds like based on the cases you looked at and the jurisprudence that the 7 year thing trumps the fact that Trout even signed an extension with the team and he would still be with it 7 years, even though he sort of voluntarily signed that extension. There's some precedent for saying that the 7 years takes precedence, but I guess the local law also trumps the collective bargaining agreement. Do we know that if Trout were able to get out of his contract, other teams would be able to sign him, or would he just sort of have to take up a new career?
Yeah, so that's the big question. Like, it's impossible to say for sure how that would play out in court, because no court's ever decided, you know, does this law trump a collective bargaining agreement? Does the collective bargaining agreement trump this state law? and I said in the piece, I think that there's strong arguments both ways. You know, I think a lot of the kind of reaction has been, there's no way this would ever work. Of course, the CBA would take precedence, but then there's other legal, you know, state law issues where I think a court would say, no, the state law trumps the CBA. If you're in a union, I don't think that the court's going to say, oh, because your union agreed, you're only going to make $1 an hour. We're just going to ignore the state level minimum wage and say you just get $1 an hour. And so there is kind of this weird intersection of how courts, not to get too bogged down in like technical legal, you know, nerdism, but how courts deal with that, you know, intersection of the state level protections and this, you know, kind of federal labor rights and collective bargaining agreements. And so I think that's really the big question of how this would play out. And one of the reasons I think it would be really, really interesting to see a player actually try to take it through the court system.
And I guess there's also the fact that he played out of state in the minors, which, you know, even though he was still playing for the Angels the entire time, could potentially weaken his case.
Yeah, and so that would be another. There are a ton of issues that would have to come up. And I think that I could imagine a really easy case. And, you know, the easy case is probably Albert Pujols. Like I mentioned in the piece, he signs a 10-year contract with, you know, as a free agent. There's no question about when the clock should start ticking. He's been in LA the whole time. You know, for me, I think that that's a relatively easy case, that he probably would win that.
I think the Angels would pay his court fees if he is interested in
exactly.
doing that.
He's never going to, but I think that that would be kind of an easier case. You know, the Trout case gets a little bit stickier because of the time out of state and because of the extension and all that. Somebody like Sean Doolittle might be a slightly easy. I haven't looked at his minor league history where he was, but somebody who's never had that extension becomes somewhere in the middle. And so there's a lot of different possible cases you could imagine and how that, you know, that would affect the likelihood of success, I think.
So this is one of those situations in which, like, we sort of treat baseball like its own entity, or, you know, sports in general, like their own, like they are very special sort of weird industries. And like, this is one of those cases where it feels like baseball would want to try to insulate itself from real world laws. Like, you know, you saw with the seasonal apprentice thing, with when they were talking about minor league pay, things like that. You know, how far might baseball go to try to set up that kind of barrier? Or is this case would just be so unlikely to actually come to pass that it's not worth the trouble?
Yeah, I think if the case came to pass, baseball, MLB would probably move heaven and earth to try to get, you know, it defeated, because it would just throw the whole system into chaos. It's not fair that players in California could do this, but nobody else could. It would totally mess up, you know, the strategic plans of five franchises and their ability to compete long term. And so I think from baseball's perspective, they'd have to try to fight it tooth and nail. And I think the easiest way to do that would just be to get to this California legislature to pass some sort of rule saying it doesn't apply to athletes or to professional baseball players, at least, which the state's thought about in the past but has never done. You'd raise a good point that baseball is kind of this weird entity. You know, I think all sports leagues at some level, I mean, they're all monopolies when you really get down to it, and the government never really wants to regulate them because, oh, it's sports and we should be doing more, quote unquote, more important stuff. And so all these leagues have a lot of autonomy that I think fans just kind of take for granted sometimes. And there's a question of, is that good or is that bad? But I won't get into that right now.
Now, I guess the team could always trade the player, right? If the player starts making this threat, if Trout says, I mean, if Trout wants to ensure that he can play somewhere with more interesting weather, which seems like something he would be interested in, he could just bring up the specter of making this legal challenge, and then the Angels could trade him to some other team outside of California. Although I guess they'd have less leverage since teams know that they need to trade him, but there'd probably be no shortage
of people
interested.
As if those trade rumors aren't weird enough already. Like, we need this other complicating factor.
I do think that that's like one error. That's probably a more realistic application of this is, you know, maybe if not Trout, somebody gets frustrated enough and says, look, I'm going to try this. And that's going to be the easiest approach for baseball and the team is just, okay, we're just going to trade you. Now you don't work for us anymore. Now you're not protected. And now we don't have to worry about it. And that might have been a reason why it hasn't come up before, because it's going to be kind of, you know, you'd have to be somebody. Again, you know, when you're trying to imagine this perfect test case, it has to be somebody who's almost untradeable because they're so valuable to their current team that the team's willing to take that risk to litigate it the whole way through, right? And, you know, even if the push comes to shove, the Angels would probably bite the bullet and trade Trout, I'm guessing, rather than let it go 3 or 4 years in court and risk losing him.
Mm-hmm. And so Deadspin asked Boris about your article. And of course, Boris is the super agent and was also a lawyer in California. And he didn't say it was crazy and nuts. And who is this insane blogger with this, you know, crazy scenario? Like, I mean, he entertained the feasibility of it, but he basically said that even if it would work, it just wouldn't be worth trying because it would take too long. He thinks it would go all the way to the Supreme Court, and by then Trout would be a free agent anyway. And meanwhile, everyone would hate him except Michael, who would love him because
I want this so bad. I'm so pissed. Like, I wasn't covering baseball during like the Messerschmitt case. Like, I want this so much.
Yeah, but I guess like everyone else would hate Trout, right? Like everyone in the game would hate Trout. I mean, I don't know, maybe players wouldn't hate him because he's just trying to get himself more money, which in turn helps them get more money. But everyone in management, probably the fans, because the fans are often against the players in the player versus team sort of thing. And this would be a very transparent kind of disloyal act, like a cash grab, or that's how Angels fans maybe would see it. So ultimately, even if it would work, he would probably be kind of a punching bag for fans of baseball across the country.
Yeah, I thought that was, I mean, you know, if Scott Boris is saying that, there's probably some truth to it, right?
Yeah. He knows about being a pariah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I respect Scott a lot. You know, I mean, for my money, he's the best agent, you know, potentially in all sports of all time. And, you know, I there's some of it, you know, people could quibble with it, like not to get into the technicalities. It's not clear to me that it would take as long as he thinks it would. I think this is the type of case you could move pretty quickly through the courts and, you know, and stuff like that. But overall, I think he's probably right. And that's probably why nobody's done it, you know. And to be honest, like when I had first come up with the idea and was thinking about it, I kind of sat on this for a while because I was like, I must be crazy. There's got to be something I'm missing. Like, what am I doing, you know? And then Scott Boris would have done this if it was possible, was like, you know, one of the first thoughts I had. And then eventually I was like, ah, screw it. What do I have to lose? It's my reputation, right? So I put it out there. But it was, yeah, I was interested to see his reaction to it. And I think that probably makes a lot of sense from an agent perspective. But at the same time, the agents only work for the players. It's not the other way around, right? And so if you really parse his words, it was interesting. He said he wouldn't advise somebody to do it, not that he would never actually do it, right? And so it's still possible he, you know, if he had the right client in the right situation, he or somebody else might still try to do it if the player wants it bad enough.
Mm-hmm. All right. Do you guys have any guesses about what free agent Mike Trout would get if he were a free agent right now?
Right now, or if like, or what would he get his extension runs out?
I guess you could give me either, but if he were to exercise this option and it actually worked and he were able to be signed by other teams and all the other caveats that we've discussed.
11 years, I guess my median guess would be like 11 years, $470 million.
Okay. You have a guess, Nathaniel?
That sounds probably, like I said in the piece, just kind of ballpark 8 to 10 for 400 or 500 million probably, but there'd definitely be an opt-out probably in there at some point too, right? Or one or more. And I think that, the other thing, reason why this would never happen right now is because all these teams are clearing money for 2018, right? And so like, it's not clear that the, you know, it'd throw out the Yankees' long-term plans of getting below the luxury tax and everything. So there'd be a lot of interesting moving parts if this actually came to pass.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I am glad you decided to write this article. The first week of January can make baseball writers do desperate things to provide content. So this entertained everyone. And you can follow Nathaniel's writing at Fangraphs. His book is Baseball on Trial, The Origin of Baseball's Antitrust Exemption. And he's also on Twitter at Nathaniel Groh. Thanks, Nathaniel.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
And we'll be back with Meg Rowley after a very brief message. Today's episode of The Ringer MLB Show is brought to you by Bachelor Party. That's right, just like the TV show, The Ringer Network's companion podcast, Bachelor Party, is back on The Ringer's Channel 33 podcast feed. As a weekly watcher of The Bachelor, I am excited about this, and you can join me in listening to The Ringer's Juliet Littman every week for a breakdown of the latest episode. You can listen to Bachelor Party on The Ringer's Channel 33 podcast feed on iTunes by going to itunes.com/TheRinger or by finding us wherever you get podcasts. Okay, so even when things are slow in baseball, even when no one's making moves, you can usually count on Jerry DePoto to be the exception. The Mariners GM is always making moves, and on Friday he made two. First, he traded an outfielder, Seth Smith, for a pitcher, Yovani Gallardo. So then, naturally, he had to trade a pitcher, Nathan Carnes, for an outfielder, Jerod Dyson. And he ended up with the same number of pitchers and outfielders that he had started the day with. But maybe they're better. Maybe they're worse. We'll find out. We are talking to Meg Rally, a writer for Baseball Prospectus and the author of the Mariners player comments in the forthcoming Baseball Prospectus annual, and a long-suffering Mariners fan. Hey, Meg.
Hi. These trades happened, I'm not kidding, literally the day after we locked comments for the annual. So, of course. So I'm like, yeah, well, Seth Smith's just going to sit in the Mariners chapter. That's a thing that's happening.
So what was the net positive or negative of this outfielder pitcher change? What motivated these moves as far as you can tell?
Well, I think the outfield motivation is pretty obvious. DePoto has talked since he came to Seattle really about trying to get younger and more athletic in the outfield. Seth Smith is a lot of wonderful things, but there's a reason that Mariners fans have taken to calling him Dad as a nickname. And he runs like you maybe expect your dad would if he were trying to field a ball. So I think the addition of Dyson really changes the dynamic of that outfield pretty considerably. And they've talked about how they're going to play him and Martin in some combination of center and left field and right field. At least for the moment, looks like it's being manned by Mitch Haniger, who came over from the Diamondbacks. So they're definitely more athletic. There's a lot of speed there that wasn't there before. And on the pitching side, this rotation is so weird. It's so bizarre. I went and looked at the depth chart before we came on. And like, for example, he probably hopefully won't get any starts. But do you remember that Chris Heston is a Mariner now? I forgot about that.
I didn't remember at all.
I forgot that happened. And I pay pretty close attention to the minutiae. So I think they wanted sort of a veteran presence to anchor the back end of the rotation. That was what motivated the Smith for Gallardo swap. But I mean, he hasn't been good for a minute now. So I don't know that it's a net positive. I think they're hoping that, you know, his shoulder is better or better than it was last year, and that he will be able to sort of quell the home run spike that he had in Baltimore last year with Safeco's dimensions. So I see the logic behind it, but I don't know that this team is necessarily better than it was, but I don't know that it was necessarily a super solid rotation to begin with. So maybe it's a net neutral, but not exactly the upgrade that Mariners fans were hoping for.
And that kind of makes it a typical Jerry DePoto trade, because I'm thinking back over the past 15 months or so since he became the GM, and he's made, like, it seems like every week he's traded a C-minus player for a C player, or a C-minus player for a D-plus player, and just sort of shuffled it all around. And, you know, we find ourselves reading takes like Mitch Haniger is the key to the Gene Segura trade. And, like, you know, last year I got really excited about Nate Carnes in the Mariners rotation. And who's, like, is this doing anything? And who is the best player involved in one of these trades over the past year and change?
Well, I mean, just to give a little ditty on Carnes, I think, you know, he had a nice start to the team. But I was thinking back to the sort of midseason check-in we did on Effectively Wild with all of these moves. And he was fine for a while, but he really struggled to get through the order a third time and got demoted to the bullpen and, you know, ended up spending the rest of the year on the disabled list. So he I don't know that he's much of anything except young and full of potential still, maybe. And I think they'll see if they can maximize that. But I don't know, like, Dyson's a fun player. Dyson's good. Like, that's a nice thing. I watched, you know, Nori Aoki try to steal bases for the Mariners last year. So watching Dyson do that will probably be better. But I don't know. I think there's a frustration that I've seen from Mariners fans that they are very aware of the window that this team has. And I think that a lot of folks were hoping that they would go into this offseason and maybe make a splashy move that would maximize this year, which I think is the last one that we can count on really being part of a contending Mariners window for a while. And these feel like like lateral moves at best. And so I just don't know. I don't know how, I don't know which one of these is good. I like the Danny Valencia pickup. I'm looking at the depth chart. Wow, I don't recognize some of these guys. And I pay pretty close attention, like I said. Wow.
Can't believe you just came on my podcast and threw shade at Nori Aoki. You know I'm how sorry. I feel about him.
I was actually sad to see him go. I think that that'll be a fun little pickup for the Astros. And now we don't have to worry about him dealing with Tulse Hill, so could be fun. Right.
Yeah. Well, so you just sort of alluded to it, but I guess if there is a unifying theme to all of the many, many Jerry DePoto moves since he took over, it's that the Mariners kind of have this window that's closing, and they also don't really have a farm system, and I guess he just hasn't felt like it's the right time to rebuild. So all he can kind of do is try to make this team a little better and kind of trade the red paperclip for a little better paperclip and eventually hope that it ends up with a division winning team, which the Mariners have not had for longer than any other team. So I guess that's the idea.
Yeah. And I think that because the farm system isn't anything to write home about. I mean, it's definitely improving, which is nice, but it's the Mariners don't have the prospects to be in the market for someone like, you know, Quintana. They weren't going to ever play in the Chris Sale market, right? They don't have those kind of guys. And I think that the hope was that they were going to maybe spend a little bit of money because there is this new ownership group and they seemed open to that. But then I think based on what DePoto said, he's looked around the free agent market and either not been happy with what was available, not been happy with the price point, or, you know, we never know what free agents want to do or where they want to go. So it could be that he's tried and we don't know about it and, you know, just was rebuffed by players who don't want to spend their summer in, you know, a beautiful city like Seattle. So I don't know. I will say this team was pretty close to being a wild card team last year. And I think that part of the hope, if you want to paint a rosy picture of what the Mariners could be, is that if they have better rotation health, you know, a lot of the offensive pieces here are the same and were pretty impactful. So if they can get better health from the rotation and get more consistent production from, you know, guys like Felix and have a bounce back or two, then maybe they're in that same sort of spot where they're contending for a wild card down the stretch. But it's not the big dramatic push. I think competing at the top of that division with the Astros and the Rangers is going to be tricky. So I think he's set his sights a little bit lower, which, you know, makes him a perfect general manager for the Mariners.
So is the team being called the Mariners? Is that why the deck chairs on the Titanic metaphor is that just too obvious to use?
I don't think it's quite that dramatic, and I think your joke is very mean.
We've been talking for 8 minutes now. I've spent all 8 minutes trying to figure
coming
out how to
up
make
with
that
joke. I mean, they're still fun, good pieces here. They're still good players on this team. I mean, they still have Cano, who's rebounded nicely from that bad 2015. They still have Seager and Cruz. If James Paxton can be good and healthy, which the healthy part is always a big question with him, you know, they do have some good pieces on that rotation. It's just a really weird one, like Rob Whalen sitting down there.
Yeah, if you look at the Fangraphs depth charts projections for 2017, the Mariners are 8th in projected position player war. So that's a playoff team caliber, right? But they are way down there in pitching war. And yeah, you look at that rotation and I mean, Felix at the top has generally been a good thing for the last decade or so, but now it's not so clear that he is a rotation topping pitcher or even close to that anymore. And then Iwakuma's coming off his worst year and Paxton seems to be really good, but has never thrown more than about 120 innings in a major league season. And then there's Gallardo, which who knows? And then there's Ariel Miranda, who has 10 starts lifetime. So I have no idea what to make of this rotation. Like, you want to talk about Paxton? I guess Paxton is kind of the bright spot.
Paxton is the bright spot. And I will say to his credit, his DL stint last year, and it would not be a James Paxton year without some injury, was more of the fluky variety than anything else. He got hit in the elbow, in his pitching elbow. Some angel did it, Andrelton Simmons maybe. So he was pitching great until that happened, and then he looked good down the stretch at the end. So I think he is the bright spot. His transformation last year was really, really fun to watch. But yeah, I don't know what we're getting from Felix anymore, which is personally as a fan a really sad reality to find ourselves in. And Iwakuma wasn't great last year, but I will say he was the only qualified starter the Mariners had, which considering that he was almost a Dodger because of concern and then wasn't because of concerns over his physical is kind of funny. But I think the most concerning thing here is just the lack of depth. Like if anything goes wrong with any of these guys, there isn't a lot of talent in the sort of high minors that could come in and back them up. And so I don't know what the solution is going to be except seeing, you know, maybe a lot more of Ariel Miranda than you want to, or relying on literally Chris Heston to potentially pitch major league innings. So I know that on Friday, DePoto said that he was not averse to the idea of continuing to play in the pitching market, which is sort of strange because I don't know what else he really has to trade away. And I don't know that they are open to spending money, really. So that might just be him trying to pacify people who were squawking about concerns over the rotation. But there's just not a lot of depth here.
Jason Hamill's still out there.
I know. And he, yes, that would make
and he would fit in because the Mariners, like just looking at this depth chart, they lead the league in guys who are 3 years older than I thought they were.
Yeah.
Like, and Hamill would be like Paxton's 28, Haniger's like 26, Dyson's 32, which was like, he doesn't look 32.
Right? No, he does not.
So Hamill would fit in there, I think.
Gallardo's always younger than I think he is. So he's trying to reverse the trend, I guess.
Yeah. And Felix is now older than I thought he was because he's been 26 in my head since like 1999.
What is like the general perception of Felix, if you can speak for the fan base as a whole? Like obviously among internet analyst types who are looking at his FIPs and his XFIPs and his deserved run averages, you can see a very clear decline and sort of a precipitous decline last year. And that shows up in his stuff and his fastball velocity and everything too. But his ERAs have to this point remained respectable. So does he still have kind of the ace aura, or does your casual Mariners fan recognize that this is not the old Felix?
I think that it's gotten to the point where they recognize he's not the old Felix. I think the optimistic narrative that we're seeing, or that I'm seeing among other Mariner fans, is that people are hoping he'll take the Verlander route. He did have some issues with his lower half last year. He never seemed fully healthy, and he did have the DL stint. So I think that people are hoping that he'll come back and maybe the conditioning will be better. He's talked about sort of starting his preparation earlier. I know he threw some innings in winter ball for the first time in a while. So I think the hope is that if he's fully healthy and he can command the fastball a little bit better, I mean, the secondary stuff is still really great. So, and he's been dealing with declining velocity for a while now. So it's not as if this is a new problem and he has to, you know, he's sort of new to having to be crafty. But I think that people recognize that he is the top of this rotation, but I don't know that he is the top of a top of rotation guy on a team that has better options. So it's sad.
Yeah, he always seemed like the sort of guy who would just be able to keep adjusting and finding new ways to be good because he had lots of pitches, and maybe more so than Verlander, who kind of had the power pitcher approach, but then found a way around it. And to be fair, he still throws quite a bit harder than Felix does. But
yeah, he does. And I don't know. I mean, we might have gotten to the point where the velocity decline is just going to limit his effectiveness going forward. I'll be really interested to see sort of the beginning of the year goes for him and how his health is and sort of how he feels. But yeah, it's just 2014 wasn't that long ago, but in terms of the decline from what he showed that summer versus what he showed, you know, is showing now, it feels like forever ago.
All right. Well, we could end quickly on a nostalgic note. There was briefly a flare up this week about Edgar Martinez because some columnist wrote that he was not feared. And then briefly, everyone debated whether he was feared or not as a player, but not always the debate that raises everyone's intelligence the most. But
that debate is infuriating for me, by the way, because people who talk about feared hitters don't put Larry Walker on their Hall of Fame ballots. Uh-huh. Just let me shout about that for 10 seconds. Okay, I'm good.
Okay. So if you look at Ryan Thibodeau's public ballot tracker, it seems that Edgar is in line for a very big boost in support. He finished at 43.4% on the final ballot last year, and he's tracking close to 70. He probably won't end up quite that high, but he's getting to the point where he looks like he's going to get in Do you want to make a quick case for any Edgar doubters who might be listening?
Sure. I will make a quick case. I think, first of all, the not feared thing is just the most ridiculous bit of nonsense that I've heard. I mean, I tend to think that players don't always have... Sometimes players are really good at assessing the skill level of other players, and sometimes they falter. But I think if you look at the, you know, the guys who have talked about Edgar's approach and how talented a pitcher he was, or hitter he was, it's hard to say that he wasn't feared. I mean,
yeah,
it's guys like Mariano Rivera. It's, you know, it's Randy Johnson. These are guys that normally most folks down and did not have that impression of him. You know, I know Johnson in particular talked about how happy he was not to have to face Edgar very often. By virtue of being on the same team. So I think that that's sort of a silly approach, and I think kind of a dangerous one, because I think it risks us overlooking players who may have played in smaller markets or on West Coast teams where folks didn't necessarily see them on the East Coast, and they can be Hall of Famers even if half the country was asleep when they played. So I think that's, you know, a bunch of silliness. And then, you know, we still see some of the anti-DH sentiment, although that I think is probably at an all-time low in terms of his individual candidacy. And I would just say that he played more innings in the field than David Ortiz. He played a pretty respectable third base. And if he had played a really bad third base for a long time and been the same hitter, I don't think we're having this conversation at all, because I think he'd probably already be in the Hall of Fame. So he's, I mean, easily the best designated hitter of our lifetime, and one of the best all time, and he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. And he's a lovely person.
Yeah, I'm not really in either extreme. Like, there's the camp that says that you can never put a DH in because they don't do enough. I'm not in that camp. And then there's the camp that maybe says, well, DH is a position and it's a part of baseball, and so if you're the best DH, then you should get in. I'm not totally in that camp either, but I think you can ding a DH for not playing defense. It's a less valuable position than someone who hits the same and also plays good defense and is good on the bases and all those other things. So I think it's fair to hold it against the player, but when that player is as great a hitter as Edgar was, you can subtract some value and still have a Hall of Famer. So I think he is quite deserving.
And you can't ding Edgar for being a DH. The David Ortiz thing, like, I'm pro Edgar, but like, I wouldn't throw a fit if he doesn't get in, but I would throw a fit if he doesn't get in and David Ortiz does.
Uh-huh. And David Ortiz absolutely will. Can I give one tiny fun fact and then I will let us start talking about this? So I was just looking at his, granted, this is only 23 plate appearances, but I was just looking at Edgar's numbers versus Mariano Rivera. And they are so fun if you're a Mariners fan. He slashed .579/.652 with a .1053 slugging. He had a .1705 OPS against Mariano Rivera. Get out of here with the not feared hitter nonsense. What garbage.
Rivera only threw the one pitch, so I guess he knew it was coming. My favorite Edgar memory is actually him getting picked off first base, like with his foot practically on the bag by Andy Pettit in a playoff series.
That seems like a thing that would happen.
It was just one of the funniest things I've ever seen on a baseball field.
Yeah. All right, you can find Meg writing every week at Baseball Prospectus. She's on Twitter at Meg Growler. And I know that there is a possibility that there might be baseball in The Bachelor this week, because in our Bachelor Fantasy League, there's an option that Nick, on his first group date, might play baseball with the contestants. I don't know what that would look like, but if that comes to pass, we might be talking to you again pretty soon.
Yeah, I hope so. Their options this week were very tricky, so yeah. I'll be curious to see how it goes.
All right. Thank you, Meg.
Thanks, guys.
Okay. So that will do it for today. We will continue to hope, as always, that some team will rescue us with a 10-player trade by the next time we have to record again. But if not, we will forge on.
Yeah. What's coming out for PC in the next couple of weeks?
I don't know. What's going on in the football and basketball world?
A lot, actually.
Yeah. Football playoffs.
Yeah.
We can talk about that. No, we have another podcast at The Ringer for that. We will be back same time, same place, same day next week. later in this episode, we are going to talk to Nathaniel Groh from Fangraphs, who wrote an article about a hypothetical scenario by which Mike Trout can exploit a legal loophole. Legal loophole. All right, let's try that again.
Okay.
Later in this episode, we are going to talk to Nathaniel Groh, a writer for Fangraphs, who wrote an article about
It's okay. I laughed in the middle of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, here we go.